New Jersey U.S. Senator Bob Menendez's bribery trial has ended in a mistrial. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Covering the 11-week-long proceedings and joining me live on the line, WHYY's Joe Hernandez. Good evening, Joe.
Hey, Dave.
Question number one, why did the judge declare a mistrial?
Well, today the jury came back to him with their second note of the week, and it said, we're deadlocked, and we don't think we can reach a verdict. Now, they brought him a similar note on Monday that said, we're deadlocked, what should we do? And this was just 3 hours after the jury had restarted deliberations because a juror was excused last week. So the judge said, you know, sleep on it, come back in the morning and try again. They did that Tuesday, they did that Wednesday, and then today they sent him another note and said, we're deadlocked. So he interviewed the jurors, and then he declared a mistrial.
Reaction from the senator?
Relief, I think, is fair to say. And when he stepped outside of the courthouse, the mood was celebratory. I mean, he gave some remarks to the press in which he broke down in tears a couple of times, thanking people who are close to him, his family, his legal team, and other, you know, his colleagues. So just happiness, I think, that this ordeal, for now at least, is over for him.
And indeed, for now, there is the prerogative of the federal government to retry the case. Is that likely to happen?
We don't know yet. The Justice Department issued a short statement today thanking the jury, but they've been tight-lipped about whether they'll retry the case or not. Since it ended not in an acquittal, but a mistrial, they can, as you said, retry the case if they want to. It was also announced today by U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that the Senate would open up its own ethics investigation into Menendez. So at least for the moment, this doesn't appear to be completely going away for him.
And as you cite McConnell, we can't help but bring politics into the mix. Will there be a call for Menendez to resign?
Well, we'll see. There have been calls previously for him to resign, mostly from Republicans. At least for the moment, he seems not to be going anywhere or doesn't want to leave politics. And he'll get to keep his seat now. There was some kind of speculation about whether Chris Christie would get to appoint his replacement. That seems unlikely now since Christie's only in office for 2 more months and then he'll be replaced by a Democrat. But Menendez will have to decide if he wants to run for re-election because that's coming up next year in 2018.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez reporting. In other news this evening, the House of Representatives voted today to approve the Republican tax overhaul, and WHYY's Dave Davies has a look at how the region's representatives voted.
Every Democrat in the region voted against the measure, which cuts corporate taxes and makes a series of changes to individual tax rates and deductions. In New Jersey, 3 of the state's 4 Republicans bucked their party's leadership and voted no, partly because the bill ends deductions for state and local sales and income taxes, which are high in the Garden State. Only Tom MacArthur voted to approve the bill. Rutgers political scientist Ross Baker says the 2-term congressman is a special case.
MacArthur is going with the leadership. MacArthur is a guy who wants to be a player in the House of Representatives. And I think that he is willing to take the chance that this is not going to hurt him.
All 12 Republicans in Pennsylvania voted for the measure, including representatives in suburban Philadelphia districts that Democrats plan to target in next year's elections. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania's 7th congressional district is considered one of the most extreme examples of gerrymandering in the country. Spanning 5 counties, the shape of the district is eye-popping. It's been described in terms of a Disney cartoon like Goofy kicking Donald Duck. And as part of our series, Over the Line, Harrisburg-based Penn Live reporter Wallace McKelvey teamed up with Keystone Crossroads to take us on a tour of the district.
What's it like to live in one of the most gerrymandered congressional districts in America? Just ask Bonnie Marcus and Bill Van Wee, who live in a picturesque retirement community in Chester County.
If you look at what our district looks like, I mean, come on, we're a laughing joke what we look like.
I don't think there's much they can do to make it any worse. That's not a challenge.
They live in Kendall Crosslands, a community run by Quakers who, as it turns out, tend to vote Democratic. Following the 2010 census, its roughly 900 residents were punted from the 7th district into the 16th, in what seems to have been a direct attempt to defuse the power of Democrats in the region. That makes retirees like Georgette Siegel, a Democrat, feel like she's been politically abandoned, a designed afterthought to the Republicans who represent her in Harrisburg and in D.C.
I'm not asking that they always agree with my opinions, but I would certainly like to have somebody there that I feel would, you know, take my opinions into consideration.
Retirees at Kendall Crosslands complain that their overtures to politicians go ignored. If they get any kind of interaction, it usually comes via canned form letters, sometimes responding to issues they didn't raise. One politician's office thanked a resident for their interest in deer hunting. That was in response to a letter about health care. State GOP leaders who drew the map defend its lines and point to the fact that it was upheld in court at the time. It is now subject to two lawsuits, one in state courts, the other in federal. A little farther up the road, the Democrat-leaning Kennett Square was similarly carved out of the 7th District. The borough shape makes it look like a square notch that was cut into one of Goofy's knees. That's particularly galling to Wayne Braffman, a local Democratic council member who's become an advocate on the issue.
This is not a political issue or a partisan issue. I knocked on doors in the borough, and I just knock on every door. I don't care who they are. And all I had to do was show them the map of the 7th. And they said, where do I sign? You know, we passed petitions.
A 45-minute drive north of Kennett Square in King of Prussia, two chunks of the 7th District are connected by a narrow isthmus of land barely wider than the property line of Creed's Seafood and Steaks.
He's working all the time.
Since 1982, the restaurant has been a favorite watering hole for business and political leaders, even a governor or two, and maybe a few of those responsible for those labyrinthine district lines.
What happens at Creed's never happened.
Owner Jim Creed, though, is happy to play host.
We don't care if they're Republican, Democrat, or Independent, or Martians, as long as they're paying.
Standing outside the restaurant, you're surrounded by the zigzagging lines of three different districts. Montgomery County is represented by five congressmen, none of whom live there.
There's nobody who gets up every morning and says, what can I do for Montgomery County today?
That's Val Arkush, a Democrat who chairs the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners. She fears that the district lines were drawn in such a way to disadvantage the county. She cites the fact that President Donald Trump's proposed budget would cut the public transportation funding that's being counted on to build a new commuter rail line that will connect Philly and King of Prussia.
In the inevitable horse trading that happens to build a budget, is there going to be somebody that's really focused on how important that particular thing is to Montgomery County? And I don't know the answer to that yet.
There's an absurd humor to these political machinations, but there's also real consequences.
I can't tell you how many times I hear, why should I vote? It doesn't matter. And if that doesn't put the fear of the future of our democracy into everybody's heart, then people need to wake up.
For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Wallace McKelvey from Penn Live.
A diagnosis of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, can be devastating for patients and their families. The rare and fatal disease slowly robs a patient of the ability to walk, speak, move, and breathe. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram visited a Philadelphia clinic where learning to cope emotionally with the disease goes hand in hand with medical treatment.
Pat Vidko remembers something she saw on her first visit to the MDA ALS Center of Hope at Temple University. There was a woman in a wheelchair who needed someone else to wipe her nose.
And I thought to myself, it's not going to happen to me. Now somebody wipes my nose because I can't reach my nose.
Vidko is 74 years old and was diagnosed with ALS 5 years ago when she was still working as an administrator for a large medical group. She's now in a motorized wheelchair and uses a ventilator off and on that whooshes during her appointment with neurologist and clinic director Terry Hyman Patterson.
What else new did you want to talk about today?
Hyman Patterson says the average life expectancy for ALS patients is 3 years or less after getting diagnosed.
Every month, there's another loss, and you're facing loss for the entire time you have this disease.
Living with that prognosis is an extraordinary psychological challenge. And at this clinic, mental health services are integrated into patients' medical care. Nurse counselor Mary Holt Pallone says that physical aids can only do so much if patients can't find a way to cope emotionally.
You know, they'll have their walker sitting beside them, and they'll get up and walk without it. I mean, or they won't even want to see the walker because it just reminds them of what's happening to them.
Holt Pallone says symptoms of depression affect the majority of patients after their diagnosis, while about 20% experience lasting clinical depression. She also works with family members and caregivers. Vitko's husband, Barry Hornberger, says he's still grieving the loss of other plans they had for their lives.
This was like a stab in the gut from day one. And there's no two ways about it. It's extremely difficult.
Holt Pallone says she helps patients understand they have a choice to make.
We can let ALS kill you before you actually leave this world, or we can do everything that we can in our human power to help you live every moment as best you can.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
The Philadelphia Eagles have defied the preseason expectations of professional prognosticators and all but the most fervent fans. Joining me with an eye toward the playoffs is Philadelphia Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Am I reading this correctly? The Eagles are now considered the favorite to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl?
I'm speechless. I couldn't imagine this at the beginning of the year. I'm one of those mistaken prognosticators you're talking about, but they're the best team in football, and I don't think it's really much of a conversation because they don't really have a weakness. They're a developed team. They're deep. They've got a good young quarterback, a good offensive line, a superior defensive line. They've got it all.
They've also had some injuries, yet in spite of that, they're still 8-1.
And that goes to Howie Roseman, the general manager, fortifying them much better this year than they have in the past. And it goes to Doug Peterson and his staff preparing guys in their second year, in the second year of the Peterson era, to do what Peterson needs him to do. This was the problem last year. They weren't quite deep enough to, I guess, maintain the momentum they started when a 3-1 and 4-2 start. They went 1-7 after that, and there were depth issues. This year, the team is so well built and so well coached. It's really a pleasure to watch.
Around a second-year quarterback who's obviously exceeded expectations, one Carson Wentz. Interesting Sunday night going against another second-year quarterback of some renown, one Dak Prescott.
Dak Prescott was the story last year when Dallas won 13 games with him as a rookie, a fourth-round rookie, I believe. And, of course, Ezekiel Elliott, who was the running back star first-round pick. These two rookies were just wonderful to watch. And also, did St. Louis / Los Angeles make the wrong choice in choosing Jared Goff, who's also having a fine year and who we'll see in a month in Los Angeles? It's really unfair to Dak Prescott right now, who has no left tackle and no running back, to say, you know, he's not as good as Carson Wentz. But he's not as good as Carson Wentz.
But we digress. Again, you're saying the Eagles are that good. But is it that some of the other teams that were thought to be as good or better have fallen by the wayside a bit?
Well, when a guy like Green Bay's Aaron Rodgers, who is my favorite football player of all time and probably the most polished quarterback, the most versatile quarterback of all time, with apologies to Montana and, you know, Tom Brady, when he leaves the scene with it via injury, it changes the paradigm. And there are a lot of teams, Atlanta, Carolina, who are sort of playing the same record, and everybody knows that tune. You know, those are winning teams, but they're not winning the way you thought they might coming into the season. You know, and Cam Newton, again, the former MVP 2015, coming off a shoulder injury, he's playing great now. The Eagles got him when he wasn't.
You touched on Los Angeles. The Rams are playing also perhaps better than expectations, and that'll certainly be quite a game in L.A. later.
Yeah, their coach McVay and their quarterback, I mean, it's Goff and McVay Wentz and Peterson, football's in a good spot right now. It's going to be fun to watch for a long time. But when you look at what the Rams face, you know, their quest to get a bye, maybe host throughout the playoffs, they've got Minnesota, New Orleans, Seattle, Tennessee, and Philadelphia. All winning teams, all good teams to finish out their season. They probably have the hardest road of any team in the hunt to win their division and get a first-round bye.
How about the Eagles?
I hate to jump on the bandwagon, but it's hard not to. They are what they are. The Wentz wagon, as some people call it. If they lose one of their games on their West Coast trip in 3 weeks when they go to Seattle and Los Angeles, that'll put them at 11-2. They could enter game 16 at 13-2. At that point, 13-3 usually gets you home field throughout. And it's hard to not see that happening.
If for some unforeseen reason they don't get to the championship game and or the Super Bowl, is this a team that's built to last for years to come?
It's terrifying how good they are going to be. They have three cornerbacks, really four cornerbacks, who are just sort of reaching their potential. And one guy, their second-round draft pick, who didn't play yet this year. He's been injured. And that's their point of weakness. Their defensive line is set for a long time. Their quarterback obviously is set for a long time. It could not be better for the Eagles right now. The coach is young. The GM is reinstated. It just looks great.
Couldn't come at a better time for a sports-starved city of late. Marcus, thanks for the optimistic words at this time.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Philadelphia Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes. The residents of a small town in northern New Jersey did not know that in their midst was a missing sculpture by the French artist Auguste Rodin until earlier this summer. That's when it was discovered hiding in plain sight in the town hall. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the marble bust of Napoleon is now on display in the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Madison, New Jersey is about 20 miles west of New York. It's a small borough of 16,000 people, and in its town hall was a bust of Napoleon, which a lot of people walked past without looking twice. That is, until a grad student named Mallory Martiaro was hired to take inventory of the art in the Hartley Dodge Memorial Building as it underwent renovations. That included the white marble bust wedged into a corner.
As she recounts it, she sort of ran her fingers over it, felt the signature by Rodin, and then that kind of sparked 2 years of bringing it to the attention of a number of Rodin specialists who were able to authenticate it.
That is Jennifer Thompson. She's curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where the bust is now on long-term loan. The piece is called Napoleon Wrapped in His Dream, featuring the head of Napoleon emerging from what seems to be a cloud, but is really the folds of a high-collared cloak. Thompson says it's unusual for two reasons. One, Rodin did not normally sculpt historical figures and was not particularly a fan of Napoleon Bonaparte. The bust was made on commission from an American patron. And two, Rodin tweaked the classic image of Napoleon by dressing him in a military cloak typical of ancient Rome.
Even the way the hair is cut is in a very sort of precise, regular fashion, which evokes this sort of the sense of a Roman military leader. You have Rodin, you know, taking liberties with Napoleon.
While indefinitely on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, this Rodin bust is still owned by the Hartley Dodge Foundation. Thompson says that because Rodin was so prolific with a global client base, it's really not that unusual for his pieces to sometimes go missing and then become rediscovered many years later. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.